Hello, everyone. Welcome to Sparkle On. I'm Davey Jags, and Sparkle is your happiness, passion, and self-worth. Today, we are sitting down with Spencer Paysinger, retired NFL player. He was part of the Super Bowl 46 winning team with the New York Giants, and now he is a Hollywood filmmaker, most widely known for the CW's show All American, where he co-produced this show, and it's loosely based on his life. If you know Spencer, and one of the things that I would love for listeners to take away is his unwavering commitment to telling stories around his community. So we're definitely going to be diving into that today on the episode. So welcome, Spencer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I wanted to start in early part of your career, mm-hmm. 2011, when you were originally not selected in the NFL draft. Can you share what this experience was like and how you overcame that to actually get signed on to the Giants?
Yeah, that was such an interesting time. Mm-hmm. So you got to go back even before that. So I don't get drafted. It was, I think, March or April of 2011. Literally 4 months before that, or 3 months before that, I'm playing in a national championship. Mm-hmm. You know, Oregon's playing against Auburn. We lose on a last second field goal. And if you're a national championship participating team, you think you're going to have some people going in the draft, more than just one.
Right.
Unfortunately, we only had one person from our team drafted that year, which is like kind of mind boggling. Mm-hmm. So we knew the NFL lockout was happening like as the NFL draft was going on. Mm-hmm. But during the draft, that kind of like opens the floodgates for just that, those 2 to 3 days. So I'm getting calls from teams. Mm-hmm. I got called from maybe 3 or 4 teams. I was like, hey, like you're on our board. We might take you, no guarantees, but obviously like none of that happened. Now, what usually happens is after the NFL draft, like the last pick goes in, scouts from all teams are calling you to sign you to a rookie contract for you to come and just try out for the team. That just didn't happen during that time. Mm. So it went from talking to these various teams through the 2 to 3 days of the draft to like radio silence for 4 months. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm back in Los Angeles. I'm living at my grandparents' house on like a twin bed, training people, like high school athletes, just to make money, just to like, you know, be an adult in this world, not knowing if I was going to make it to the league or did I play my last down of football. So during that time, it was a lot of some bouts of depression, some bouts of just like what's going on. Mm-hmm. I had foregoed a job opportunity up in the Pacific Northwest to get into a management company, mm-hmm. a company's management program to be fast tracked into a management position. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I told them no. It would have been, I think, $80,000 a year coming out of college in 2010, 2011, which was like pretty good.
Yeah.
I told them no, I want to come back for my senior year. I want to, you know, play this last year with my guys. Mm-hmm. Fast forward a year, and I'm just like sleeping on a twin bed in my grandparents' house, like, oh man, mm-hmm. you know, what's going on? And it was interesting. During that time, I ended up researching like all 32 teams of kind of like what they needed from a linebacker, what they needed on defense, what were their strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I actually found there was about 4 or 5 teams that could use a linebacker of my expertise. So a little bit taller, X receiver, can guard tight ends and running backs out of the backfield and whatnot. And it came down to like 3 to 5 teams that if they called, I was like, oh, this is a good position for me to go to, a good place to go to. Mm-hmm. Fortunately for me, the Giants called. And the Giants were like one of the top 2 teams on my list that I thought, oh, this could work for me. And during that time, it was weird because you just didn't really know what your future was. You didn't really know. You come from such a structured environment where I went to University of Oregon. Like, mm-hmm. you're on clock from 6:30 in the morning to like 7:30 at night every single day, it feels like. Mm-hmm. Meetings, school, practice, back to meetings, XYZ. Going from that to just being in the wind in Los Angeles, like having to make your schedule and having to like do your own workout plans and all that type of stuff, like it really threw me for a loop because I had grown up and grown into an adult always being around, you know, at minimum 60 guys in a weight room, in a locker room, on the field. And now I'm just this single entity out in the world. So mm-hmm. it was definitely like a rocky time, mm-hmm. but I just lean on my friends from Los Angeles, like a lot of my high school friends. We connected, you know, my wife who I went to high school with. That was the time when I started like courting her. And, you know, her and some of my other best friends, like really got me through that like 4 month period.
And it kind of goes back to, you know, again, that community. And so when you were going through this transition, you know, life is uncertain. What were you telling yourself when it was crystal clear that things were uncertain?
Just that for me, it was, you know who you are. Mm-hmm. You know what you can provide to a team.
Right.
You know that you had this great college career. You were on a national championship participating team. And it's always weird saying national championship participating team. But like, you're not somebody that is just allowing life to happen to you. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of different pivots in my life that I've had to sort of take care of, had to handle, had to address full on. And it all came from the mindset of, I can go this way or I can go that way. Mm-hmm. And I think up to that point, the life choices that I made had me on the right path. Right. So it was just telling myself at that time, like, hey, this is one of those moments for you that you're going to look back on and 5, 10, 15 years and go, this is another pivotal moment in your life. Which way are you going to take? Are you going to, like, you know, go to the club every night and drink and smoke and do all that stuff and party and act like you're like invincible? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to like find some balance in yourself of knowing if you do get a call from a team, you will be ready to then go and compete for a job?
And, you know, you've talked about you're always an artist, which a lot of times in athlete culture, harnessing that craft and that creative process is really difficult to do. Did you pursue your passion for writing and filmmaking while you were a professional athlete?
Well, actually, I found it while I was a professional athlete. That was something. So writing in general, the process of writing, the process of, you know, opening up Final Draft, looking at that blank page, having a story in your head and just like putting it down, that all came about when I was in the NFL. Now, growing up, like, again, I was an artist growing up. I would draw and paint, and I was the kid that would print out Dragon Ball Z pictures, put them in my backpack and trade them like cards with my friends. And then me and my friends in sixth, seventh, eighth grade, we're trading pictures with each other because we all said, let's get our work done fast so then we can start drawing these pictures in class. So it was like, I was always that person that was like, you know, touching the canvas, like grabbing the pencils, grabbing the charcoal, like making something out of nothing. Mm-hmm. And movies and even TV shows were something that I just did. Like as a kid, you just watch. You know, I remember watching like the most random movies growing up. Like I can recite every word to Grease. Like, why is a black kid from South Central, like Rocky Horror Picture Show or like First Wives Club? Mm-hmm. Or like, and it was because it was something really cool in my family occurred that only a few years ago I really understood this, but my dad and two of his three brothers mm-hmm. were football coaches. In general, sports, basketball, baseball, football, like they pretty much coached me from pretty much birth through high school. My one uncle that didn't necessarily identify as like a football coach or the sports guy, he enjoyed movies. Mm-hmm. So he's the guy that would take me to the movies like every single weekend. Mm-hmm. That weird, awkward age where you're kind of too young to run the streets with your friends, but you feel like you're too old to be at the house with your parents on the weekend. Mm-hmm. My uncle was like, yo, let's go to the movies. So we were seeing stuff that I probably shouldn't have seen at 11, 12, 13 years right. old. But I think early on, if you had to whittle down where this sort of, you know, idea that I could become a writer or I could become a producer, it starts with him. Because he had me in the movies. He had me like dissecting stories at a young age, or would call me up and say, hey, I just watched this movie, go see it and let's talk about it. So when I got to the NFL, that actually became a therapy of mine. It was something that during those first couple years, or the first couple weeks actually in fall camp, my mind was just beat to shit. So I don't know if I can curse here.
Yeah, of course.
but you know, you're learning, I'm on the East Coast. I don't know anybody on the East Coast. I've never been to New York before. I'm there battling for a position against other players that came from schools that all these coaches understand and came from themselves. And I'm just kind of outlier from Oregon. And I just went to the movies. Like those first couple off days, I was like, I don't want to see nobody. I don't want to hear nothing about no football. Mm-hmm. I want to go sit in a dark theater with my popcorn, with my water, and just like get lost, you know? Yeah. And I kept that up for 7 years. Every Tuesday, every NFL off day, I would see a new movie. Didn't matter runtime, title, like genre, anything. I had to go sit in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. And about two or three years into it, I was just like, oh, I think I might be able to like write some of the stuff I'm seeing, because I found that I was breaking sort of story structure down in my head before I knew what it really was.
Right.
So, oh, this is the end of act one. Oh, now he's in this new world. Oh, now she's in the pits. Oh, she's about to learn something new and she's going to have the big battle at the end. So it just started with me like reading books on story structure, downloading Final Draft, because I think Final Draft on my iPad was like $8, but Final Draft on my computer was like $180.
Yep.
I'm in the NFL, but I'm like, I'm going to take the $8 option. So the first, like, I think the first couple ideas I wrote was just me just tinkering on my iPad, but mm-hmm. it quickly became a hobby that just consumed. Like if I wasn't on the field, if I wasn't at the facility, I was just at home just trying to figure out like, what's the best way to convey an emotion or a thought, an idea through just the art of screenwriting, the structure of screenwriting.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting. And why I really latch on to your career story is because, you know, when I was an athlete, by the way, never near the level that you were at. So let's just make that very clear.
Don't sell yourself short.
It's okay. We can. But I had a really dark struggle with my entire identity was my sport. And Sparkle was actually born out of kind of realizing that I couldn't have only one identity. And so Sparkle is all about embracing your various identities, but it was born out of a really dark, dark period. And Friday Night Lights is actually the movie that like kind of woke me up. It was like, oh shit, this ends. And it's like, yes, we all know it ends, but what does it look like when it ends? It looks like that movie. Yeah. Heartbreak. Yeah. But you never really subscribed to that kind of culture where football was everything. And you even said that you wanted to be out by 30. So do you think movies was kind of the way that led you to that next chapter, or was it a combination of things?
I think movies and even the idea of a show like All American in its infancy, like it made it tangible. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this really lofty goal coming into the NFL at 21, 22 years old that I'm undrafted. I'm mainly a core four special teams guy. Mm-hmm. I make the team and I tell myself if I can play until I'm 30, I want to walk away. It doesn't matter if I'm top of the league in my position, bottom of the barrel, or just kind of scraping to get by. I'm going to walk away from this game at 30 because it kind of started with even my parents. Like my parents, we were the sports family. You know, mm-hmm. I was at my local park, Van Ness Park, from 8 a.m., 7 a.m. to like 5 p.m. because my mom ran the concession stand. My dad coached three teams there. And me and my two brothers were there for my little brother's game at 7 a.m. We're there for my game at 1 p.m. We're there for my brother's game at 3 p.m. So we just grew up in that. But one thing I'd always credit my parents with, and even my family in general, was like, we were never the family that was like, you have to do this one thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, I was part of the math club. I was part of the science club. I've done all those things, even like I said, with art. Mm-hmm. So anytime I had interest in something, my parents were like, okay, go explore it. Mm. Like it was never, you can't do this because you're the athlete.
Right.
So I was fortunate enough to be in a family, again, full of football coaches, of baseball coaches. That my dad coached at the collegiate level. And my uncles, they're responsible for getting, I mean, hundreds of kids into college just by how they were able to guide them through high school.
Right. Sorry.
And that all being said, they just never allowed me to just go, I'm just an athlete. It was, what else do you want to do? Mm-hmm. And I give credit to the first mentor that I had outside of my family, James Harris, was he was a nutritionist at the University of Oregon, and he saw something in me. He was just like, hey, I see you're like looking at things differently. You're an econ major. You carry yourself well. Like, I'm going to plug you into the community of Eugene, Oregon, and you're going to meet businessmen and women. You're going to grab coffees. You're going to grab lunches. You're doing all that. And it really struck up this just really cool, like, mentor relationship to where he just taught me how to see the world and how me being an athlete for the University of Oregon has a certain power to it that I can get into rooms that other people couldn't. Mm-hmm. So he taught me how to cold email people. He taught me how to cold call people. He taught me how to like request to get to grab that lunch or that coffee with that business person that's probably too busy to do it. Mm-hmm. And I just carried that in through the NFL. Like for me, I was an econ major. So I thought, I legit thought I was going to have the power tie. I was going to be on Wall Street. I was like going to broker the deals and all that. And even those first couple of years with the Giants, I was doing those things. I was doing the internships and the job shadowing experiences in that world. Screenwriting was something that really just kind of took over on its own. Like again, it was mm-hmm. the hobby that kept getting louder and louder. But I attribute that to me going, I'm interested in something.
Right.
Let me explore it. I don't have to be interested in something in spite of me being an athlete or a pro player. It's just kind of all goes in the same pot for me. Like when I walk away from the facility, I'm just a regular person in the world. I'm not Spencer Paysinger, linebacker for the New York Giants and the Miami Dolphins. I'm just Spencer Paysinger. Mm-hmm. So it's going and seeing Moonlight and coming back to the locker room and telling the guys like, yo, you got to go see it. You're not going to like a couple scenes, but you got to go see it because of this and this and that. Or, you know, being on Wall Street and bringing that knowledge back to the locker room. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just never subscribed to the idea that if I'm an athlete, I cannot be anything else. So,
Moonlight is a fabulous
script. Fabulous film.
Amazing. Well, you know, what's also interesting is even when you were talking about this mentor relationship that you had in college, and even when you were, you know, pitching teams of like how you could contribute to the, on special teams, it's like, that's Hollywood, like mm-hmm. on the business side of it.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. The reason why I made the Giants roster is because I pitched myself in such a way. Mm-hmm. You know, we're 2 weeks into fall camp. Again, I'm this lowly rookie that is from 3,000 miles away. And if you're one of those undrafted guys, those teams really only pick the majority of those rookies to come in from the local area mm-hmm. schools. So the Giants had a large influence on like Boston College, Pitt, University of Pittsburgh, and, mm-hmm. you know, those type of schools around there. They're not really looking at University of Oregon.
Right.
So we're 2 weeks into fall camp. And again, under Chip Kelly at University of Oregon, if you were a starter on offense or defense, you had to start two special teams. He was just creating well-rounded players. Mm-hmm. So we're 2 weeks into fall camp and I see our special teams coach just yelling at the veterans to like do these drills right. And I'm looking at, I'm holding bags and stuff, kind of being the dummy of it all. And I'm like, oh, I can do these drills in my sleep. Like I was a 3-year starter at Oregon in these same drills. I mean, mm-hmm. in these same positions. So one day after camp broke, I walked over to the special teams coach office and I was like, hey coach, like, I don't know if whatever, do with this information what you want, but like I was a 3-year starter at Oregon for special teams. Like I can do all these things that you're like killing these guys to just do right or take half seriously. So he saw, he was like, okay, I'll give you a shot. And mm-hmm. that next practice, I was running with the ones on special teams on all the core four and never looked back. And he even said it. He was like, yo, if you didn't come talk to me and like tell me like who you were and like what you could do, he went back and watched film of me as a special teamer. He was like, yeah, this makes sense. Like you should be up here with us running with the ones because you know how to do the stuff. So if I didn't have that intuition to go and talk to him and say, hey, I can do all the things that you're looking for, mm-hmm. I probably would have a different history at this point.
I want to go into this a little bit more because I think, you know, it's easy for people who don't know you or just in general, right? Mm-hmm. To look at someone who's, oh, in the NFL, they got everything they wanted because they were in the NFL, or, oh, they went to this school, they got everything. Mm-hmm. But there's a type of spark in certain people that talking really does open the doors that you want to open. Mm-hmm. And I think especially now with young kids, whether they're young athletes or young students, they're not always taught what it means to just ask or pitch themselves. And mm-hmm. I'm lucky enough where I am that type of person. I mean, how I got myself, I had not the greatest grades. I was a solid runner that could get to D1, but like I wasn't, you know, I didn't have people coming to my house. Mm-hmm. But I would sit in my guidance counselor's office and just start writing pitch letters. And then that was the same concept I took to when I was pitching articles for magazines and so on and so forth. And pitching in a way is still a learned skill.
Yeah.
But with someone who has a shyness, right, it doesn't mean they don't have this spark and this ambition. How would you suggest that they like exercise that muscle?
Yeah. I think it starts with, you have to have a bit of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. I think for me, the things that I've been able to do and the paths I've been able to take, it all started with kind of seeing a play to be made, mm-hmm. and understanding if I am or am not the person to make said play. So for me, at a very young age, I always felt like my superpower was the ability to have self-awareness. Mm. Like you said, like, I was not the biggest, the fastest, the strongest, the smartest player, but mm-hmm. I knew that if you give me the playbook, you teach me the playbook, you put me on the field to learn the playbook, when you put me on the field for the game, you will not have to worry about me. You can worry about the other X amount of players on the team, on the field, whatnot, mm-hmm. but I always saw myself as somebody that the coaches never had to worry about. Mm. And when I'm pitching myself, I'm pitching just that. You know, the fact that I've been able to landed at two different destinations through free agency, it was pitching them myself and having my agents at the time pitch them as like, this is a guy you will not have to worry about. He will not be an issue in the locker room. He will not be an issue in your city. He will come to work. He will never miss a meeting. He'll be part of the team. He'll make tackles. He'll do the things you want him to do. But it came from just knowing who I was, knowing what I can offer. And if you're the shy person, lean into your perspective of being a shy person. Mm-hmm. Like if you're timid, if you're sometimes overpowering, like you can turn all those things to strengths. And that's what pitching is. You're right. Literally just pitching. You're turning the best and worst of you into a version that a company or a production company or whatever, an entity needs. So it really just comes back to like, if you don't know who you are, like how can you pitch yourself to somebody mm-hmm. or to something? You know?
And it's also just about embracing who you are, in the sense that like I always say, like my biggest strength is my passion, but mm-hmm. it's also my biggest weakness, because mm-hmm. I can form such a tunnel vision that I don't see the world around me.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, how can you have something come to fruition if you don't use what's around you, the people around you, listening to the stories around you? Doesn't mean passion's not good, but it can be, you know, can be lethal too.
Yeah, I mean, because like you want to do everything.
Yeah.
I think, and that's why we've had our friendship mm-hmm. of like, I see somebody in you, like you're somebody that thinks you can do everything. And you want to do everything. And my perspective is, it's not a matter if I think I can or cannot do something. Mm-hmm. It's more of a conversation with myself of if I want to do it or not. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if I want to go fly a plane, I'll go learn how to fly a plane. If I want to bungee jump, I'll go learn how to bungee jump. So it's like, I don't think anything's ever like too daunting. It's just a matter of, one, do I have the capacity to learn how to do it? Mm-hmm. And then two, like, do I actually want to do it or not? But I don't think I put any limits on myself. Like I also told myself, like, I'm not in the business of telling myself no. I'll let the business do that. If I have a good idea that I think should be a movie or a TV show or whatnot, if I think it's a good idea and I'm getting 200 no's, I'm like, all right, maybe we'll change some things. But it's not a matter of like, they're telling me no, so I'm just not going to do any type of this concept. It's just a matter of figuring out which way or how I want to construct it to get that yes, or to just do it on myself. I mean, do it by myself.
So speaking of pitching and putting yourself out there, you know, All American has a lot that's based on your real life. Mm-hmm. How did you pitch the show?
Oh man, it seems so long ago now. it was this weird experience where I didn't know how important the meetings. I didn't understand the magnitude of the meetings I was having until like maybe years later.
Wow.
And it started with a now good friend of mine, producing partner. His name is Dane Mork. He was the first idea that became All American. And that just came from bye week, year six. I'm at his apartment with our mutual friend on the West Side. And we're just talking about like growing up in Los Angeles, football culture. You understand names from different high schools during the different eras. And it was just weird because we were talking about Los Angeles and we were both speaking to the love we have for Los Angeles. But when you ask us our specific POV of Los Angeles, I'm a black kid from South Central. He's a white kid from Palos Verdes. Those are two completely different like universes mm-hmm. that are only separated by like 10 miles, you know? Mm-hmm. But when you're in Los Angeles, you rep it to the fullest because you're from Los Angeles.
Right.
So I went back to playing that year. He called me a couple weeks later. I was like, hey, a concept that I was pitching is dead in the water. But for some reason, something told me to just pitch them the idea that like, hey, I have this friend. He's an NFL player. He's won a Super Bowl. He's teaching himself how to screenwrite. And he went from South Central to Beverly Hills every morning to go to school. That producer who became, he's Greg Berlanti. He was like, hey, there might be something here. Like, can he write us something? Just anything to encapsulate what that experience was, being a black kid from South Central going to a predominantly white school, mm-hmm. of Beverly Hills High. So he called me. I was studying against the Buccaneers at this point. I put my playbook aside, took out my computer, and like just wrote literally like a 2-paragraph thing. But mind you, I'm 3 or 4 years into like learning how to write in story structure and kind of take you on the ebbs and flows. So within that 2 paragraphs, I took you to the highs, but I brought you down low and kind of left this lingering idea of you want to see something like this on TV. That was enough for them to have a meeting with me. I think it was like the second week of 2017, I want to say, mid-January. That one meeting, it was like fireside chat. I was sitting down with some of the producers and just telling them like, oh, you know, one of my good friends in high school like OD'd on heroin and like went away for 6 months and came back like nothing happened. Oh, you know, one of my cousins like was involved heavily in gang life. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of there in the middle, you mm-hmm. know? That was enough for them. Like 2 weeks later, they called, they reached out to my sports agent because I didn't have an entertainment agent at the right. time. They're like, hey, we think this could be a TV show. Like, can we go into contract negotiations? So for that last year I was playing, I was developing the series while still being like a active player in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And when we pitched the series, I know it's kind of like a roundabout way of getting there, but I think the reason why All American worked, especially in its infancy, is we pitched the series through a universal truth of being an outsider.
Right.
You know, the advice that I would give to anybody out there wanting to create a TV series or a movie or whatnot is, when you're pitching it, find that universal truth that anybody in the room, no matter race, culture, or creed, can understand. And for the majority of the pitches, you know, I'm kind of satellite because I'm literally in New York playing for the Jets at the time when we were going through all the pitches. So I'm like through Skype or Zoom or whatever the thing was at that time. Mm-hmm. I'm just signing in for the first 10 minutes being like, hey, I'm a real person. Bye, I have practice, you know? But we were pitching the series on the idea of like, it doesn't matter where you're from, how much money you make, like what's mm-hmm. your background. Everybody can understand what it's like being an outsider in a new space. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really, outside like the social issues we were talking about within the show and like a different POV of the Friday Night Lights, 90210,
yeah.
Gossip Girl type structure we were putting it in. Mm-hmm. Everybody understood what it meant to be an outsider in a new space.
I mean, that's really good advice because I think part of which makes some of the CW shows so successful is that universal truth, especially with the young teen dramas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of teens see themselves in those stories, even if they've never even stepped foot in LA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we were, to be honest too, like when we pitched it, when me and Dane were initially thinking about what this can be, we did not see this as a CW show. You know, right. We were like, we're not saying this was like Euphoria or something, but I'm 36. I grew up on Unnecessary Roughness, Any Given Sunday, The Program, mm-hmm. like sports, movies, and TV shows that really like playmakers from ESPN back in like, I think 2001, like this was a show that, I mean, this was the era of sports, TV, and film that I grew up in. It didn't shy away from like a lot of the underbelly that came with the sport. Mm-hmm. So that's a version that we really did want to tell.
Right.
But when we started talking through it, especially with, you know, 100% credit to Greg Berlanti and some of the producers early on it was, if we did this right, we could be the next spoke in the wheel of like generational high school teen dramas that come down the pipeline every 7 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. You have the Gossip Girls, the One Tree Hills, the 90210s, the Friday Night Lights. At that time, we didn't really have that show to define that year. I mean, that era of like 2015, 16 to like 2023, where like high schoolers were they were changing. Like it was George Floyd. It was COVID. It was all these different things. And he really Greg sat us down and some of the other producers was like, if we do this right, we could be the next generational show that like defines the era of like teen experience, which I think we've accomplished.
I think so too. I mean, that's how we got connected. But it also can't be easy to have some of your real experiences portrayed. And so I'm kind of curious as what are some of the biggest misconceptions of how people perceive you as mm-hmm. real Spencer and the fictional character?
Oh man, there's so many. and this was interesting. I started to realize at the end of season one and kind of through season two and stuff that Spencer James was actually changing my history. So if you're seeing me walking down the street, and again, like this rarely ever happens, if any, but like if somebody walks up to me like, oh my God, you're Spencer, like from All American, Spencer James. I'm like, yeah, Spencer Pacinger, nice to meet you, whatnot. They will start like peppering me with questions of like, did you get shot? Mm-hmm. Did you do it? And I'm just like, nah, that's not what happened. Or like, no, it happened a different way or whatnot. And I started to realize like, oh wow, like Spencer James is now becoming like the common knowledge of my own history. And for a little bit of time, it made me think that, wait, is my own history good enough? Is the actual story of how I got to Beverly Hills and how I did these things, like, is that good enough or is it not good enough? And that's why we have chosen to go like this different route for Spencer James's story. Mm-hmm. And I've had every emotion that like under the sun that comes with, you know, I've talked to like middle schools and high schools and they go, have you been shot before? And I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, I'm like, wait, what? Like, I think it's a good thing I've never been shot before, guys.
Right.
But I think that some of the common misconceptions is like, I never lived in Beverly Hills. That was something mm-hmm. we did for the show just to make the show a little bit more, you know, dramatic teen drama. Like right. there's a structure that you play with when you're that teen drama show on a network. Mm-hmm. You know, I never actually lived in Beverly Hills. I always lived at my house in South Central and just commuted every morning. Mm-hmm. Like my father is not dead. I know he spoiler alert, but my dad is still alive and well. He's remarried. He's like, you know, I talk to him weekly, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was for a short period of time, I realized I had to get to the deep work of like, why is this affecting me? You know, why am I getting annoyed that a version of my history is being altered? Mm-hmm. And it just came down for me of going, you're a producer on the show, you're telling your stories to the writers in this room, and we're putting it through this machine that then makes it consumable for the masses. You did your job. Let them do their job and tell a compelling story. And I think there's a little bit of like ownership that I had to like let go. Mm-hmm. And you really have to, at that point for me, I had to go, Spencer James is not Spencer Pacinger.
Right.
This is a character that we have created to, I guess, be a beacon for the teen experience of that era. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell my story from 20 years ago. I don't even remember half of it. So it's like we were fortunate to have a Spencer James and all the other, you know, amazing characters that we created on the show kind of be beacons for the different perspectives that teens are experiencing or have experienced these past, like I'd say 10 years at this point.
Right. And how have you actually then found joy in your own narrative?
I think just the DMs, the appreciation, the fact that like my aunt was in Africa like last year and they were raving about All American. And I didn't even know we were seating in Africa, you know, like I've been hit up and reached out to from so many different interesting corners of mm-hmm. the world. And I'm like, wait, how do you guys like this show? Like what? So I think there's a lot of appreciation in that. Mm-hmm. And again, at the end of the day, like I'm a teammate. Like I'm the consummate teammate. Like it's never about me. Mm-hmm. It's all about like achieving a common goal. And coming from sports, being put into this environment where not everybody in a production is like keen on making sure everybody's getting, you know, their just due or their equal share or their fighting for the right stories to tell in the rooms and whatnot. I'm somebody that it doesn't matter how I'm treated or whatever, if there's a team goal that needs to be attained, like I can be that teammate to help push us there. Mm-hmm. I can get the no's. You can tell me you don't like something. I can move the soap boxes. I can like be there at 4 a.m. picking up, like, which actually happened, like picking up glitter off the field because we like blew a glitter box too soon. Like I'm the teammate that just wants to have the best product on the field, on tape, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find appreciation for is like nobody on that set, nobody in the writer's room or the producers can look at me and go, like, he's just mailing it in.
Yeah.
Like I find joy in this story because I know I'm doing my part mm-hmm. in making sure it's the best story it can be from my POV.
Yeah, I love that. And you also you've co-founded a production company called Moore Street Productions.
Yes.
And that tells stories between the intersections of sports and community. One of my favorite docs that you did on the unscripted side of your work is BS High.
Yeah.
Which yeah. tells the story of a fake high school in Ohio, Bishop Sycamore, where they play the esteemed prep school, IMG Academy. Can you tell me why this was an important story for you to tell?
I think the story was important for me because on one hand, when I first heard that this was happening, I didn't see the game. I was just seeing like, what's going on Twitter right now? Wait, there's a school that got blown out, like, but they're saying it's not even a real school. So how did this happen? And when the world was pretty much shitting on BS High, mm-hmm. Bishop Sycamore, I'm not going to identify them as BS High, Bishop Sycamore. I was like, there's no way being in those locker rooms on the field, understanding so much has to go like right for 50 plus people, the athletes, as well as the coaches to be in on this con. That it just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense that they would have 18, 19, 20, 22-year-olds all willingly being like, we're just going to lie. So that was the initial reason I was like, nah, I think there's a story here. Because mm-hmm. who's lying to who? They can't all be in on the secret. And if they are, that's interesting of how they even got them all to be in on that secret. And the other thing was the fact that these coaches, there are these type of coaches in every city, in every community, all across the world. Mm-hmm. Like naturally in the US, like it's prevalent with like youth sports and whatnot.
Yep.
But coaches that somewhat prey on the youth that are tasked with bringing these youth athletes, these high school athletes, these prep athletes into manhood, mm-hmm. like that is a very serious position. And yep. I think a lot of coaches, there's not really a good like vetting system. A person can just say, I want to start coaching, and they can get onto a local team and they could bounce around. And now we're trusting them mm-hmm. to lead our children into puberty, into adulthood. And I always say this as a father of two young kids, I am not raising my kids by myself. Mm-hmm. Me and my wife are not raising the kids by ourselves. The world is raising our kids.
Yep.
So when they are in front of a coach, what is that coach about? Mm-hmm. What are their beliefs? What are they teaching these kids when we're 50 yards away in the stands just watching it happen? Like, I want to understand who these coaches are. Mm-hmm. So BSI to me was something I was drawn to tell that story because one, the poster of BS High, it looks just like my dad. Like I saw the silhouette of the figure that they have. And I'm like, that could literally be my father right there. Cause my father was a football coach. Mm-hmm. So knowing that and knowing everybody probably has a coach or an uncle or a father that's in that position guiding young athletes, I'm more familiar with that story than any other story. Mm-hmm. Or with that experience and any other experience like in my life right now, because I've been through that.
No, you're hitting on a really important note, I think, especially for listeners that don't know the youth sports yeah. world. You know, I'm a board director on the Army of Survivors, which raises awareness to abuse in sports. And it is like the youth sports industry is insane.
Yeah.
And yeah. people don't, you know, my father, he used to say, it's kind of like the concept of it takes a village, right? When you think about the breakdown of a student athlete or just students in general, they're going to school at 7:30. they're spending at least 7:30 till almost 3 o'clock with teachers. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to their extracurriculars, whether that's art club, whether that's sports, it's then a coach or more teachers. Mm-hmm. And then you might get your kid for the dinner time and then homework and then bed and repeat.
Yep.
And I think that's also where this very important conversation of education comes in. And I guess as a father yourself, how are you balancing kind of lack of control mm-hmm. of what your kids are being taught, what they might be taught in the future, mm-hmm. but then instilling your family values in them to grow up in a way that, you know, you're proud of?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. I think for us, it goes back to the community element. You know, mm-hmm. I'm part of a really dope community of friends and colleagues that we've all made a choice to live in the area that we live in. There's at any given time, if I send a group chat out to those friends and colleagues and whatnot and say, hey, I'm having something in my backyard, it's nothing for 15 to 20, you know, little predominantly Black kids to be in the backyard and their parents on the patio with the fire going and us talking and hanging out and just kind of being in community. And I think that's the important thing, especially with everything that's happening now in the country. Mm-hmm. Like, we kind of have to turn inward.
Yep.
You know, I made a point in 2016 when my wife was pregnant with our daughter. Mm-hmm. During the 2016 election, mm-hmm. my wife saw it on she saw the writing on the wall and said, I'm not watching this, I'm going to sleep.
Yep.
I stayed up and watched the whole election. I'm sitting at the edge of my bed and I'm looking at, you know, Trump getting to office. And this is before All American. This is before like some of the other businesses that I've been fortunate to be a part of. And I made the commitment to myself and my family to go, I need to make sure like my circle, my community, my neighborhood is as strong as it can be, because I cannot rely on this man, this person out there in the world to have any sort of impact of my just day to day.
Yep.
And, you know, fast forward to now where I have a 7-year-old daughter, I have a 5-year-old son, and he's now back in office or will be back in office. Mm-hmm. It's kind of doubling down on that mission of no matter what the world looks like, what's going on, I need to make sure the neighbors know who I am. I need to make sure they know who my kids are. Mm-hmm. I need to make sure the person walking down the street sees me and says hello, because I'm going to say hello because we need to be in community, mm-hmm. in neighborhood together. And I think I'm pouring that into my kids to where they don't need to, they're going to understand that the world is this big, grand place where all these different perspectives and viewpoints and ideologies are going to kind of crash in together. But when they are in their community, that is the thing that they can control.
Yep.
You know, the school that we have our kids in, it is a school that teaches our kids that they are young Black kids in this world. And it's not because I'm against diversity or anything right there, but this world is going to attempt to tell young Black girls and boys who they are, mm-hmm. earlier than these kids can develop a sense of identity for themselves. So for us, it was really important for us to put them in a school that's led by a Black female doctor that has predominantly Black women as teachers, that they're talking about probates, they're talking about African-American studies, they're talking about African studies. Like, my daughter comes home singing like Negro spirituals and stuff. So it's like, I understand that the world is going to like force my kids into like certain boxes that they think. It's up for me to instill in our kids that you don't have to walk into those boxes willingly.
Yep.
You know, you can define yourself for who you are and how you want to be presented in this world. And for them to have such a strong identity of self early on, of being young Black kids in this city, in this country, in this world, was like paramount for me and my wife. We'll get to them being part of the 5% that is at a middle school or a high school, whatever. But right now, it's really about incubating like who they are in this world, mm-hmm. Just through a specific perspective.
Yeah, and I it probably helps them be comfortable and their most authentic selves.
Absolutely.
And especially even now as adults, and we're in this period in our country again. It really is leaning on what does our communities look like? who are the types of people we want to surround ourselves with, and also the art that we lean into, whether we create it ourselves or absorb it from others. And, you know, despite, like you said, what's going on in the United States and the outside world, you've done that through even your investments and ownership with Hilltop Coffee and, and Kitchen. And that is right in your neighborhood. So can you speak to that venture and what that was like to create this, this space for your community?
Yeah, I mean, ironically, Hilltop and All American were kind of being pushed at the same time together. Arguably my closest friend, his name is AJ Rilan. He's the creator of Hilltop, him and his business partner, Yoni Hagos. So they run a hospitality company called Good Vibes Only Hospitality. And at the time, if you've been to LA, if you're a millennial, whatever, in LA, you have a story about being at their sports bar that they own called The Parlor. It was off of Melrose, and they had pretty much a 10-year run where they were the sports bar to go and watch any type of game, Super Bowl, like any type of championship. It was just the kind of the best place to be in the summer, you know, being mid-20s or whatever, you just found yourself there. He grew up with my wife's family. And at the time that him and his wife at the time were pregnant, we were pregnant with our daughters as well. And they, you know, their daughter and our daughter are now like the best of friends. But he was like, hey man, I'm thinking about kind of closing up The Parlor. I want to do something more family friendly, more like poignant for the neighborhood. Like I'm thinking about doing a coffee shop. And at the same time, me and my wife, we had just moved into our house. And in our neighborhood, like there wasn't really that many options for us. And we were like, oh, maybe we should put a coffee shop in as well. So you got these two different entities thinking about the same thing. That next week, he took me to this old tax office and was like, I think this could be our first location. And I think about a year later, we ended up opening. And it was such a, in hindsight, I had no idea what to expect getting into that industry. I just knew, and it's kind of been my thesis on like how and where to invest. It's like, I love investing and pouring my time into people that know how to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of have to like be a little bit more cautious because I'm not the millionaire athlete. Like I'm not the guy to sign the big contract in the NFL, but if I've been fortunate enough to be in situations where good friends of mine who are experts in their field have opportunities coming up and they just allow me to tag along. So for me, Hilltop represents something that was born out of a need for community at that time, but then also from a handful of people in the neighborhood that were all having kids at the same time that wanted their kids to grow up knowing a sense of ownership, knowing a sense of like, hey, that's ours. You know, we have four and a half locations across LA because we have a partnership at LAX with Randy's Donuts. But when we drive by one of the shops, like my daughter's like, hey, that's Hilltop. Like, you know, we own Hilltop. We have a piece of Hilltop.
Yeah.
And there's just power in that. There's just power in seeing how where we came from in, 2016, 2017, it being an idea to what it is now, like, that's why we did it. You know, I can go back and talk about how big the mission was and this is what we want to do, but, like, it was kind of just being along for the ride and allowing myself to be surprised and just kind of honestly riding the coattails of two really good friends that had experience in the restaurant industry.
That's interesting how you said that you allowed yourself to be surprised. I think sometimes, especially as creative people, we lean towards our passions and interests and it takes us somewhere. But then really when you allow yourself for the uncertainty and to explore and be surprised, it takes you to new levels.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Oh man. I've recommitted to writing. I think in this industry, in TV and film industry, you spend so much of your time on the business of being creative instead of just being creative. That what's next for me is kind of just building out my structure for my company. You know, the past couple of years, it's been sort of a by-project basis. And me and my producing partner, Dane Mork, that's how we've been operating. And now it's just about it's about expanding our foundation, expanding our structure, making sure like when we are kind of stacking these things on top of each other, whether it's we're directing a series for UCLA football right now, where I'm writing a film about, you know, the only black man to make it to the NFL Hall of Fame without playing the game. you know, is a phenomenal scout in the late 60s all the way up to the 20 teens named Bill Nunn. Mm-hmm. So it's about right now I'm writing, I'm developing, I'm trying to be the best dad that I can, the best husband that I can. That comes with a lot of therapy, a lot of like books, a lot of like rediscovering, kind of like rediscovering like my own joy, my own systems, redefining my own systems. Cause again, 36 now, I'm looking at 40, not as a sense of like dread of, oh my God, I'm 40 now. It's like, oh no, like that's a, I want to earn the right of like old age. I want to earn old age. I want to have the privilege of it, I would say. Mm-hmm. So it's really gearing up over these next 5 to 10 years of, from a company standpoint, building out Moore Street to be a big player in both scripted and unscripted. But then as a man, as a husband, as a father, making sure like I'm just present as much as I can, as much as I can be, not scrolling as much on my phone. but then also like me and my daughter and even my son now, we're starting to have like those real conversations.
Like, I love that.
We're starting to have, like, me and my daughter the other day, we went into this whole conversation about Trump and about the country.
How old is she?
She's 7.
Yeah.
And she's coming with, like, because her school definitely, like, she's in an advanced program. The school is an advanced school, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But she's coming with, like, thoughts. It's not just he's the president now. She's like, well, how does this affect us? And what's, like, is he going to hire people that are going to help us? And I'm just like, all right, let's get into it.
Yeah.
So it's being right now as a father specifically being equipped to distill this information to her to a point where she can understand it. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not so sure my parents like did that to me. And again, I think like my generation, like we're starting to uncover all this like trauma and stuff that's happened to us, and we're putting names on it, we're labeling it, and we're actively attempting to address it. But what comes with that sometimes is like degrading our parents of like all the things that they didn't do for us.
Right.
And one thing I always say, like in my head, I was never poor growing up. Mm-hmm. My parents gave me everything that they can give me under their own power. But more importantly, my parents raised 3 black kids in 90s South Central off of Slauson and Western, and none of us like touched gangs, violence, anything like that. Like that in itself is a success story. So as a parent now in that position, I give praise to my parents for raising me and my brothers with like 1/5 of the resources that I have to raise my kids with now. Mm-hmm. And not putting that on my kids to be like, back in my day, well, we had it this way. It's like, no, like y'all should learn, y'all should live from this place of abundance that we've been able to create. But it didn't just start with me. It started with my parents. It started with my grandparents. And even beyond that, all the decisions they made to get me into the position where, I know I'm going along with this, but a year or so ago, there was some crumbs on the floor. Mm-hmm. And I was telling my daughter, like, hey, you left those crumbs there. I want you to pick them up because we don't want roaches to like come in the house. And she looked at me with a dead face and was like, what is a roach? And I was like, I think if anything, this is the clearest example in my head that I think I have made it to where my daughter can't readily identify what a roach is, you know? So it's just like going back to like your question, just like being present to be able to be there for them and raise them to be as like strong and empathetic as possible in this world, because you know we don't know where this world's going, but I'm not going to sit here and subscribe to the idea that like everything's going to hell, because again it goes back to your community and like what you make it.
That's what I appreciate about you, is you are a leader in these community efforts, and you've been so open about how your sparkle has changed throughout the years, and you make others feel okay with that change and embracing it. So thank you, Spencer, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sparkle on.